Welcome back to Artworks. I'm Annie Corrigan, in for David Wood. Indianapolis native Kurt Vonnegut wrote acclaimed novels such as Slaughterhouse-Five and developed a worldwide following. The author, who died in 2007, never wrote an autobiography, but a new collection of his letters serves as the next best thing. The letters were collected by Vonnegut's longtime friend and fellow Indiana author Dan Wakefield. Artworks' Adam Schwartz speaks with Wakefield, editor of Kurt Vonnegut Letters.
Dan Wakefield thinks he knows why his lifelong friend Kurt Vonnegut never wrote an autobiography.
I don't think he would have ever written an autobiography. I think he would have considered that kind of pretentious.
Wakefield grew up with Vonnegut in Indianapolis and is the author of such novels as Going All the Way. He's the editor of the new book, Kurt Vonnegut Letters. The book collects Vonnegut's letters written over six decades to his children and colleagues, friends and adversaries. One of Wakefield's favorite letters describes an event that took place in an Indianapolis bookstore.
When Slaughterhouse-Five came out, and it was a bestseller throughout the country, and people were lined up around the block to get his autograph. But when he was in Indianapolis, he wrote me a letter, and he said, I spent the afternoon at L.S. Ayres' bookstore signing copies of my book. He said, I sold 11 copies, all of them to relatives, I swear to God.
One of the pleasures of reading Kurt Vonnegut's letters is that his tone of voice comes through, that kind of arch, cantankerous, funny, and yet with an underlying seriousness. You can really hear his voice in his letters.
Yes, yes. He never put on any airs in his writing or in his conversation or in his talks. His persona is always there, whether he's writing stories or novels or letters.
January 16, 1992. Dear Mark, it has always been the case with me that when my life is a mess, I can find some relief by writing. So I am, after a year of hacking out trash on my IBM Selectric, at last in control of material which can be another novel. Like this country, it should be completely finished in another year. Cheers, Kurt Vonnegut.
Vonnegut's first marriage was to his high school sweetheart, Jane Cox, his second to the photographer, Jill Kremens. In 1971, he wrote to his daughter, Nanette, about these relationships.
Dear old Nanny, I still love your mother, but we can't be together without fighting. We have tried to do things about this, but nothing helps, and each fight hurts more than the last one. I wasn't stolen away by another woman. I don't think people can steal other people. I simply went away because the fighting was making everybody so unhappy. And as you know perfectly well, people need people. And Jill is who I have now. Love, Kay.
He was very upset by banning of books, certainly of his books. He wrote a passionate letter to the president of the Drake School Board in Drake, North Dakota.
Dear Mr. McCarthy, I am among those American writers whose books have been destroyed in the now famous furnace of your school. I read in the newspaper that your community is mystified by the outcry from all over the country about what you have done. Perhaps you will learn from this that books are sacred to free men for very good reasons. If you are an American, you must allow all ideas to circulate freely in your community, not merely your own.
Kurt Vonnegut did not write an autobiography. So, in a way, this book might stand as one.
Yes, I think it is the most wonderful kind of autobiography, and it tells the story of his career, his life, in a way that I think nobody else could, and the story of his life certainly does come through and is expressed in his letters very eloquently.
I I've been speaking with novelist Dan Wakefield, editor of the new book Kurt Vonnegut, Letters. For WFIU Arts, I'm Adam Schwartz.
The excerpts from Kurt Vonnegut's letters were read by Richard Fish. Learn more about Kurt Vonnegut at the official Kurt Vonnegut website, Vonnegut.com. A retrospective of the work by Barry Gelt is now on display at the IU Art Museum. Focused on the artist's embrace of landscape painting beginning in the 1980s, the exhibition Barry Gelt Embracing Nature also includes several important examples of his earlier figurative studies. Barry Gelt retired from IU's Hope School of Fine Arts in 2007 after a teaching career that spanned almost 40 years. He continues to paint and exhibit his work both in the U.S. and abroad. Gelt joined WFIU's Yael Cassander in the studio, along with Linda Baden, who curated the exhibition, and Rachel Berenson-Perry, who wrote the essay for the catalog that accompanies the show. They speak about the nature of creativity and the necessity of struggle, and what makes a landscape painting real.
To introduce Barry Gelt and his work, I like to read a letter from a former student of Barry's that's included in Rachel's essay. And I feel that this letter speaks to Barry's intensity and your commitment. Matthew Ballou says, "Regardless of how anyone may feel about his subject matter, Barry Gelt, the painter, is inescapable. And the density of his surfaces and absolute no-holds-barred approach to the physical act of making paintings are undeniable. His achievements as a teacher and a painter are inextricably tied to his belief in image making as a way of life. He is a man who has been able to keep investing in others for 50 years, while at the same time finding a way to hold tightly to home and studio, diligently creating works that really do embody something of his characteristic force and grace, directness and nuance, speed and depth." And I'll follow that up with a conclusion to the essay that Rachel has written for your catalog, Barry. And she says, "This indomitable search for an authentic singular voice is motivated by Gelt's stalwart belief that music, art, and writing are the ultimate expressions of the human soul. His landscapes embody a great paradox. They're timeless, important works of art that are uniquely of our own tumultuous time." I feel like this quotation about your unshakable belief in the power of art and the necessity that we uphold this tradition is matched by something epic in your work, Barry. There's something large and kind of universal.
You know, I think I went to art school my whole life from age 17, studied sculpture in Philadelphia. And then I went to art school, and then I went to Yale University graduate school. And that was a time of great events in our country. There were race riots. JFK was killed, you know, 2 months after I started grad school. Medgar Evers was killed. I had a cousin that was murdered in Boston. And so there's big events surrounding your life. And Yale really made us deal with big issues. It wasn't an easy school in that sense. And when we backtracked, our instructors told us that you didn't come here to paint in the past, that you had to be part of your own time. And that really has stuck with me. And so when you go into your studio every day, or almost every day, I'll put it that, you know, it's a thrill to walk in the doors and close the door, and you kind of walk inside your own brain. And it's a great experience, is to sort of, you know, tackle your own world. It's a struggle to make a painting. I mean, all my paintings are about struggle, basically. Like what lies behind the horizon line, whether it's the ocean or Indiana landscape. We never know that. We don't know what lies ahead of us. Especially when you're younger. You know, you don't know if you're going to get married. You don't know if you have a job. You don't know if you're going to be able to paint forever. You know, it's all, you know, what's life going to be like? Can I buy a car? You know, can I buy food? You know, in a way, those things weigh heavily on your head when you're young. But even in painting, it's a struggle. I mean, you know, a lot of times artists will say, this is hard to do. I don't buy the word hard. I think there's a struggle in being creative. I think creative is intriguing, you know. But I don't like the word hard. I think you go to work, And it's enjoyable. It's a struggle. I'm not always happy. And but being hard is like, you know, being hard for me would be lifting up a 100-pound bag every day and, of like birdseed. You know what I mean? That's hard, you know. I think being creative, it's a right. dumb word for creativity.
Right. There is this sense of struggle in your work and a sense of great conflict and conflict coming to a resolution. Just, I would say, in the formal elements. But let's backtrack a little bit as far as the paintings are concerned to the first paintings that you did and how responding to the events of your time maybe was more obvious and narrative.
Yeah, I had a kind of a same question along those lines because when you're doing figure paintings, the narrative kind of comes with it, whether you're explicit in the narrative or whether you're, it's just suggestive. But as soon as people see people, they want to make up stories about what they're looking at. And with the landscape, you don't want to do that so much. But I think it's not the landscape. I think it's your landscapes. I've just been thinking about this. I think that you could have been very literal and very depictive in your landscapes if you had chosen that. And then you'd still be telling a story, but instead of it being a story about two people sitting in a room having a meal, it would be a story about the scene in front of us. But you don't do that. So can you kind of talk about the difference between a depictive landscape and your landscape?
I know that with ex-colleagues of mine or current painters who I'm friends with, that I think myself as a realist. And I know that sounds strange for most people, but I think my work looks realer than other people's work. And that's not a criticism of this work, just that I think that my paint is real. I mean, you can't help the physicality. That's real. The landscape is physical. The landscape is real. And I just have a feeling that when I look at my own work, I feel like I'm really experiencing my own life. It's like it's coming. I think when I paint, I want something to come to life in front of me. And I want to bring that experience to you. And I think it's important that nature is spoken of in those terms, because if it goes, it's gone.
Well, I really like what you've always said, which is that you wanted to paint a place. You didn't want to paint a piece of a place, but the essence of the place. And I think that's what really comes through for me when I look at your paintings, is the essence of what you were feeling when you're in that place. You're more of a participant than an observer.
Yeah, I get that feeling too. You know, especially the seascapes, you can almost feel, you can smell the salt air, but it's not because it looks exactly like you expect the sea to look, but there's something that's so evocative of the experience that you get it. And I think if you didn't have the experience, you wouldn't have been able to give
every image is a place that I've been to. You know, I mean, and have experience. I mean, living there, vacationing there for a period of time. You know, if I stayed in the city, I probably never would have painted the landscape. You know, I was a figure painter in graduate school, and I was painting about the riots where people were very anonymous in a city. And I actually liked the idea of being in a city where you're anonymous to other people. You actually walk around, everybody's saying hello to you. You know, I thought that's kind of really nice. You come to a small town like Bloomington, it was nice. Everybody knows you. You got to say hello all day long, you know.
And so you have paintings from that early time, Barry, of trains, phone booths, what looks almost like hotel rooms. So these kind of anonymous places.
Right.
Public places or just transitional places.
In graduate school, there were like a lot of people. Actually, they were running around. There was people like in a lot of activity against walls, really inspired by the imagery we all saw from the race riots, basically, and changing of America. And so we were, as a young person, you really see America changing in front of your eyes for the better, you know, but through tough times. And then once that period ends and you discover more and more about art, I started to find that I had a real passion for like Dutch painting. And I've always loved Vermeer may be my great hero. And I started to paint family. And I painted my wife. I painted friends of ours at dinner tables. And I was doing little parodies of them in the paintings. And, you know, and then after a while, you say to yourself, all I'm really doing now is painting other people. And so your talents are given over to other people, in a sense. And I thought, you know, I think there's something richer inside of me than painting just your friends and family. And, you know, and so I try to figure out a way to paint more about myself. And I was fortunate enough that we live in the country, and my wife's mother bought a property next to us of 112 acres, and attached to our property is 122 acres, and it's a lot of ground to roam on. All that roaming and climbing and hiking and being on my tractor and bush hogging kind of just opened up new ideas to me, and it gave me a way to paint more physically, which I really wanted to do.
Can you explain a little bit more, Barry, about how the landscape allows you to paint more of you versus painting figures?
What's it about the figure paintings? I know I'm talking with both Linda and Rachel over, well, Linda like for 40 years probably, and Rachel in the past few years. I think art doesn't come out of nothing. I think it comes out of real heady things that happen in life. I wrote something down here. That great art is not made out of nice things. You know, and all through time, it's been made out of tragedies and big ideas and big statements. And if you paint about nothing, you have small paintings. I don't care how big they are. They're small in thought. And it's not a world I want to enter into. And if you aim for mediocrity, you're mediocre. And I'd rather fail trying to paint about something important.
And so something about the largeness of the outdoors allows you to convey those ideas a little bit more?
Well, go back to what Rachel said. If you just hike through it and you say, oh, that's a nice tree, you paint a tree, that's great. But that's not what I'm intrigued by. What I'm intrigued by is like the sense that the earth is really important. You know, so what's a landscape? It's the universe. It's a continent. It's a city. It's your home. It's where you raise your children. I mean, the landscape is really a rich idea. I want to be part of that kind of tradition where you're really talking about big ideas and the things that are important to you.
But going back to your saying that painting something small makes a small painting, another idea that I've really enjoyed that you've introduced me to is the idea of making something out of nothing in so many words. One of my favorite stories is when you took some of your collectors back into the backyard where you had made the paintings of waterfalls. And the paintings of waterfalls are these incredible dynamic pieces with a lot of movement, and they're just overwhelming. And you took them in the backyard, and they saw this little kind of trickle of water coming down there.
And they were expecting Niagara Falls.
And they said, what? That's it? That's the waterfall? So
artistic license.
Yes. But creating something out of nothing, I mean, in so many words, is so much more noble than what you called creating nothing out of something, which is taking something and putting so much detail and explaining so much of it that it just becomes something fairly insignificant, if that makes any sense.
There's a term in Japanese called wabi-sabi, which when I first saw it, I thought it was a condiment for food. I found out that it wasn't. But then you ask all your friends what it means, and it's, oh, I know what it means. And it's very hard to explain it. So I asked one of my former students, Aki Tori, and she said, I want to ask my father, who's an intellectual. So she writes him an email, and he writes back, and he says, I have to think about how to explain this. And he said, wabi-sabi is when you make something beautiful out of nothing. And so, like, the moss on the ground is important. The rust on a building is important. The bark on a tree is important. So it's a very textural life. And I think I don't aim for texture. I don't aim for paint to be thick. I don't aim for thunderstorm. They somehow evolve. Like the nature of the painting becomes the landscape as you keep working. And I'm not always in I have an idea where I always know where I am. You know, and I even probably know the time of day where things are, but how it evolves is kind of the will of the painting sometimes.
These comments really remind me of something that occurred to me when I was going through the gallery with Linda. It seems to me that you're so much more interested in recreating than you are in representing. And you keep talking about the life of the painting and the nature of the painting, almost like it's its own ecosystem. One of these very small paintings, well, it's not so small, it's just thin, The Distant Waterfall. That's where it really occurred to me, because it is a representation, in quotation marks, but it seems something about the density of the pigment and the sense that I have of excavation that is in your work at all times feels almost like you are creating your own physical landscape with that paint on that panel. So it's so much more about, it seems to me, responding in some way to that natural world and then creating your own parallel universe.
One of Barry's collectors, Tony Maravec, said that it's like he takes a piece of the earth and sticks it on your wall.
Yeah.
Barry actually pushed, I think, the sculptural qualities of the work to the limit with one of the paintings actually that is in Tony's house. And it's so three-dimensional, really turned me on. But we couldn't borrow it for some reason, or it wasn't. We had to be very discriminating about how many paintings we were allowed to have in the space. But it's a very wonderful painting.
For listeners who have not seen the paintings yet, I'm hoping we can describe them physically, especially the paintings from the last 15 years or so, the paintings' formal qualities and their physical presence, because it really has been such a transformation, such an evolution over the years, even though you've been dealing with similar ideas, wanting to confront big issues, wanting to talk about big ideas, wanting to express yourself more and more. The paintings themselves look so different from 40 years ago to now.
When I look in retrospect at Barry's work, I see two really pivotal times. One of them was when he decided to explore printmaking. Actually, when I saw one of his prints, I didn't realize it was a print. It was so textural that I thought it was a painting, because he had made so many layers on the print. But the printmaking, I think, may have been a pivotal time when this texture became very important. And then another time was when he created the painting we all refer to as Big Red. I don't really remember what the
Red and Glow or Night.
The Red and Glow, which is one of the bravest paintings I've ever seen in my entire life. I don't know how in the world he came up with that from looking at Indiana clay. It's
so abstract, isn't it?
It's so abstract, but it's so immediate and forceful.
It looks like an abstract expressionist painting to me.
Right. It looks volcanic.
Yeah.
I mean, and so I think that was almost, may have been, I don't want to put words in the artist's mouth, but just kind of a release to complete freedom. I mean, maybe Barry could speak to what happened when he created Big Red.
I don't think you always know.
Yeah.
I just, you know, what I do know is I should have made about five of them. You know, no, but I mean, like, you know what's interesting? I was just being the show with Mark Rushman.
The Indianapolis dealer.
He's doing figure paintings. I was in two galleries in New York City that closed down. So it wasn't that the figure paintings weren't accepted or acknowledged, you know. No galleries were around. And so when I made this big turn, it was like retooling yourself. You know, it's like once in your life you do something that's just so challenging to yourself that it gets you past a hump. Mm-hmm. And so it's like I just almost stopped figure painting like overnight. And the only reason was I just had to get somewhere else. And it was like cold turkey in a way. And when you have a show coming up, you have a tendency to go after a similar subject matter. So a show is – having a show is different than just going to your studio and painting every day and doing a painting this week and I'll do another painting next week. A show is really an accumulation of ideas surrounding a big idea, you know. And at this time, I had no shows coming up, and Mark had just become a fan of my work, I think, invited me to the gallery. So it was just changing. If it was now, there'd probably be like five red paintings of different sizes or temperatures. You know, but back then, I was just kind of, you know, like it was on the wall with other paintings, and I just fell in love painting it, you know. And so it becomes, and maybe luckily, it's an anomaly in a sense that it's a painting of its own right, you know. But of that group, Linda has a painting from that group, and Somebody has another painting for that group. And they're all, I think, majestic paintings. But Big Red only happened once. And you can't go back and I cannot go back and do a – if you said to me, can you paint me a Big Red painting? I really couldn't do it.
Right.
You know, I don't
right. –
it's not in your head any longer.
Right.
That's painter Barry Gelt. He's speaking with Artworks' Yael Cassander about his retrospective at the IU Art Museum. Barry Gelt Embracing Nature is on view at the Special Exhibitions Gallery through the end of December. Joining the conversation are Rachel Berenson-Perry, retired curator of paintings at the Indiana State Museum and the author of the essay in the catalog that accompanies the show, and Linda Baden from the IU Art Museum, the curator of the Gelt retrospective. Coming up, Barry Gelt admires plein air painting, but it's just not for him.
I don't enjoy painting outdoors. I have no ambition to it. When I do it, I get bitten by mosquitoes. You can't have your coffee. You can't have your music on. I'm a studio painter. I mean, that's what I do. I go to my studio and I paint. That's how I'm creative.
He has managed to richly depict natural scenes from the comfort of his studio. More from Yael Cassander's conversation with him about the retrospective of those works, Barry Gelt Embracing Nature. That's coming up in a few moments. Production support for Artworks comes from the Brown County Art Guild, featuring a collection by early 20th century painters and over 50 contemporary artists. Located in the historic Miner Home in the heart of downtown Nashville, hours and featured exhibit information at browncountyartguild.org. And the Ferrer Gallery, a gallery in downtown Nashville showcasing original, contemporary, and traditional art and fine crafts of South Central Indiana. Over 30 artists represented in a variety of mediums. And you're listening to Artworks, a weekly program that brings the arts to radio. Welcome back to Artworks. I'm Annie Corrigan, sitting in for David Wood. Before the break, Barry Gelt has been explaining the circumstances surrounding his making of the painting affectionately known as Big Red. He painted The Reddening Glow of the Night in 1994. He's joined in the studio by Rachel Berenson-Perry, Linda Baden, and Artworks' Yael Cassander.
Well, you had already been painting in the landscape for a long time and painting landscape for a while when you did that. This does seem to represent a real departure, though, from a more literal depiction where there are branches and fissures and rocks and that sort of thing. I'm interested in your approach to the landscape as far as your working method is concerned. Was there ever a plein air practice? Was there ever you going out there with a little panel?
No, it's like a funny argument. And, you know, plein air painting is gorgeous. I mean, you sit there and you make these gorgeous small paintings of what's in front of you. I can't do it. I don't enjoy painting outdoors. I have no ambition to it. When I do it, I get bitten by mosquitoes. You can't have your cup of coffee. You can't have your music on. I'm a studio painter. That's what I do. I go to my studio and I paint. That's how I'm creative. You have to remember, in a way, to paint the way I do. It's memory, but it's memory of real things. It's not like, these are not fictitious places. You know, I'm even giving titles that are time important now, because if there's two paintings with a half hour apart of the same subject, they're totally different paintings. Yeah. You can tell they're from the same subject, but they're not alike. Because nature changes so rapidly. We always say like summer, spring, winter, fall, like a song. But you know, the increments of all that is incredible. You know, so I think when you first start out, yeah, you're happy for a winter painting, and you do a summer painting, but now it's like to see the half hour is so different, you know.
Right. And so can I pick up on that? One of your heroes is Monet, and you went to Normandy to paint in his footsteps. Monet, for example, is someone among the other Impressionists who was interested in painting those incremental changes in the illumination of a spot. So at Etretat or something, you would see the cliff at 4 p.m., the cliff at 4:30, the cliff at 5 p.m. Now, his practice was informed by plein air painting.
No, I don't think so. I'll tell you why.
This is a shocking revelation.
No. He painted outdoors, but the outdoors was his studio. I mean, when you go to Giverny and you go to his gardens, it's all fictitious. It's not French. It's like Disney World. It's just gorgeous. It's like a fantasy world.
Right. There's even a story of him taking the leaves off of a tree in order for it to conform more to his
vision. I thought it was in Florida at one point. Then you think you're like somewhere else. And then all these flowers are – I mean, it's like you're inside someone's brain. I mean, someone once said that to me. And one of my first art teachers says, you want to paint from inside your brain. And you understand what that means. And so when you go to Monet's gardens, he's not plein air. He's painting a creation that he's already – it's there. It's all there. It's all art.
No standing with his portable easel in front of the cliffs?
Oh, yeah. I think that was a bit different.
Uh-huh.
But in a way is – so you go to Etretat, you know, where everybody's painting. Even before him, there was Delacroix and Van Gogh, Courbet. Uh-huh. And so when you go there, you think, oh, I'm going to see another – I don't know what it is. You go there and your knees buckle. And I just think that you go there and you see the same thing that maybe hundreds of artists have painted, and it takes on a different personality, you know.
But so the other can thing, you just describe to me, Barry, how your, for example, your views of Etretat, you have 1 through 5, and they do seem like they have different light and they're at different moments. Tell me how it's different and your practice. And
because when you go to Normandy and you go to the places where all the landings took place, which is just up the cliffs from Etretat, and it's supposed to be all the same kind of terrain. And you go to cemeteries and you see what, you know, our soldiers, the Canadian soldiers, the English soldiers all had to do. It was an impossibility. I mean, Eisenhower even knew that we'd lose 100,000 men. He just said, I think it's more than that we lost, but he just says, I know we're going to lose 100,000 people in this. So you come in at high tide, right? No beaches, just bunkers up there. You can't go to Normandy now and not have that on your shoulders too. So when I painted those paintings that that people seem to like, it has as much to do with Normandy as World War II heroes as it does to do with Monet and Courbet and Van Gogh, my other heroes. So for me, being contemporary, they coincide. You know, I mean, and that's the emotional part of painting, that either you have it or you don't have it.
But looking at the actual paintings, one reason why I think they have so much appeal is because the palette is so much more, to me, optimistic than the palette in a lot of the works. And then also the viewpoint, because you're either looking down, like a bird would be looking down, or you're right down in there, in the.
But there's no footholds. I mean, yeah. You know, in most of the paintings that we, by the other painters, you can walk on the beach, you know, or you're in a little rowboat going near it, and these are really painted with the idea of high tide, no beaches, impossibility of going up a cliff. So that's part of my idea that, like, it's not about being nice. You know, the paintings are about the difficulty of getting any. You have a big view of it, but you can't walk in them. There's no place for you. And that seems to cover a lot of my thinking about history, double histories in this case, you know, art history and then, world history. So I think those paintings were pretty loaded for me, actually. You know, so you ask a question that's direct, but I can't give you a direct answer because it seems that these paintings were made with both those ideas coming together on me.
So you've shared with us that you're a studio painter. Tell us more about the process of making, especially these paintings over the last decade, these extremely heavy sculptural sort of behemoths.
I like that. I used to paint on canvas. But as the paintings got thicker, the canvas really, I thought, couldn't support the weight of the paint. And also, if you paint up, I'd be losing gallons of paint dripping to the floor. And I thought that was kind of irresponsible to my wallet. In a way, I mean, you're joking, but, you know. But so I went to panels. And it took me a long time in the beginning, painting on a panel is not as sensual as painting on a canvas. It was like when you have a brush on a canvas, the canvas actually pushes in. So if you like put your thumb on your arm and you press, you feel your hand go into the flesh. That's the same way as a brush does onto a canvas. Like you really feel a tactility. And so I had to give that up and almost like again retool myself to a whole new material. So I was using panels, which were made for you, and a panel is like it's like a frame with a birch plywood. It's not nailed down. It's very carefully carpentered to be right, and then you prime it so that so the wood is not absorbent. Just like in canvas, and then I paint on top of tables, big tables in my studio, and about every week I'll put the paintings up and make corrections to perspectival or scale points of view, and then I lower them down again. And I love it because I drag paint on with brushes. I have scrapers. I cut cardboard up in little squares, but it's a softer edge of a steel palette knife. And I pull back and forth on it. But the paint is so long and I need these long marks. I have stands with poles on them, and I can literally like walk or run back and forth with my brushes and put these long skies and a long water. I'll paint back into that, but you know your arm just can't move 7 feet without it sort of wiggling all over the place. I mix paint in cups and cooking cups, and then I'll pour it on, and I pick the panels up and I move the panels around so that paint will flow a certain direction and kind of create something which I didn't expect. I like when things happen that I didn't expect, just like life. It's good for you. So it throws you off a little bit, and then you got to sort of get it back into order again. So I like the idea of the unexpected, then recreating order. So, and I think in figure, when I did figure paintings, there was a geometric order. Now my order is about balancing. So it's like if you put a rock in your hand that weighs 7 pounds, let's say, and put the other hand out and say, how many rooms of feathers would it take to balance that 7-pound rock? Maybe 10 rooms would be, and that's what my paintings are like. It's a balancing of colors and paint marks and thicknesses. So it's not just putting on thick paint. It has to be in the right place. Yeah. It's not, you scrape it off, you move it around.
Yeah.
So it's a balancing act of disproportionate parts.
What strikes me as really remarkable is that even though the painted object itself is so kind of unwieldy and you have to go through all kinds of acrobatics to even approach it and deal with it and have it down on this axis and then put it up on the vertical axis and then dealing with massive amounts of paint and scraping and moving, that the paintings nonetheless maintain this freshness and gesturality and a sense of, even though they are largely abstract, a sense of an actual observed place that has a consistent light that is very real and feels like something that someone has seen. I would say, in fact, that your landscapes, this work that is more almost imagined and almost more abstract, has more of a sense of life than the earlier works mm-hmm. that involved figures mm-hmm. and...
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I think that, too. There's such freshness in them. And yet when you look at paintings that are done on site, they often don't have that freshness. They're stale. So that is kind of one of the miracles of Barry's work.
There are artists who believe, and for them it's probably good, that 6 colors can give you everything. And really what that gives you is a gray palette. And that's okay. I mean, if that's what you're interested in, it's like a tonal palette, that's what you get. And I really think that in painting and the artists who I seem to like, that the field is color. I mean, I want to be a colorist. And I want the color to, and color seems more real to me. There's a blue cup on your table next to you, and it's a gorgeous color, wearing a pink shirt, and Rachel's wearing a turquoise vest, and then it has like this tannish color. All these colors are gorgeous. Why would you want to not deal with that? I mean, in a sort of way, I want to deal with the reality of what's in front of me in some way, and not to be afraid that a big blue in the background can't still stay back there. You know, so to me, color is something which I've always been intrigued with and naturally drawn to, and I don't want to do things in my work that destroy the color.
Yeah.
So you fight to keep it there. I mean, they're not like Degelow greens, and you know, it's not color like that. But I want the vitality of the world as color,
right,
to be in front of your eyes.
But if you look at, for example, this painting, early September, 5:30 a.m., Oyster Island, Korea, Gulf of Maine, the colors are absolutely stunning, and they are colors of nature, but they're those gorgeous colors you're going to get on the sea at 5:30 in the morning. I mean, the colors.
You just have to get up early in the morning and get outside, get your coffee, and
so you get outside, you take a look, and then you must have a remarkable photographic memory to be able to.
We all do.
Convey that essence
you
of
learn
that.
To, you just use it. I mean, you learn to use it. That's all. I mean, you get used to looking, and you get used to, you know what you're looking for, and you have your memory. And
well, let's talk about the colors in terms of how well they are shown off in the current exhibition, which has a particular innovation.
Yeah, it's the first show that we've been able to light with a new lighting system that's LED lamps that give us a very even across the spectrum, visual spectrum of light, and very high definition. So what we're able to see with Barry's paintings is as close to true color, as close to the color as Barry probably saw it in his mind's eye when he painted it, without a lot of yellow and amber, which is what happens when you put incandescent light on a painting, without the blue light that comes from daylight, which people assume is, you know, they call it natural light, but all light's natural. So it doesn't have quite that coolness. So it's a little bit cooler than we're used to, but the trade-off is it's much better for the works of art. So it has no ultraviolet in the spectrum at all, and ultraviolet degrades artworks very quickly. It has no heat in of the projected light at all, so that heat also is bad for artworks, so we eliminate the heat problem. It has this beautiful spectrum of light that we haven't been able to achieve, and it's a very, for us as a museum, a very flexible system that we can break apart and reconfigure almost at will. Designed for us by Rob Shakespeare, who is a professor of lighting design in the IU Theater Department, and a genius, an LED genius, and he just felt that he wanted to move us forward into the 21st century with our gallery lighting. He volunteered to do it for us. Originally, I just asked him to help me find a graduate student to light the show for us, because I knew that with these very long, narrow, horizontal paintings, we really needed someone who could fine-tune that to keep the light even. We were going to use the old lights. It was going to be a very simple process. And then Rob just kind of stepped up and said, well, we're doing this, let's do this right.
Rob Shakespeare, of course, the artist of the light totem.
Exactly. So our intention is this winter we're going to switch out the rest of the special exhibitions gallery. And then as the money becomes available, we'll change all the permanent collection galleries over to the system.
Terrific.
So we're very cutting edge with this light system. We've gotten tremendously positive feedback about the system around the country. Barry's paintings just look gorgeous in that light.
I agree.
That was the one thing I worried about, was I didn't want people to think his paintings are so wonderful because of this magical light we're putting on them, which is not the case at all. His paintings are wonderful, but the light takes some of the static out, and it lets you see the detail on the surface that the dim light levels of incandescent light wouldn't let you actually see as well. So it was a great experiment.
As far as representing Barry's work and the special challenges it presents with that panoramic format, how did you decide to tackle that challenge in the catalog, which you edited?
Yeah, well, Brian Garvey, our really fabulous head designer at the museum, knew Barry's work really well. He looked at everything that we were going to put in the show, and he designed the format. Some of these paintings have been reproduced before, but always in a way that was frustrating, especially for Barry, because of their narrowness, they would be reduced to postage stamps, basically. So early on, we knew that we wanted to spread the long horizontal paintings. And we originally were thinking about gatefolds, which are where you have the extra sheet folds in, and it would have been really nice, but very, very expensive to do. Janet Rabinowitz at IU Press said, don't do that. Just go through the gutter. It will be fine. Just spread those paintings out. So we took her advice, and we did. We went through the gutter in a lot of these long paintings. And for the first time, you can really see these paintings, I think, in a book, give some sense of how fabulous they are. We had the photography all done, most of it done in-house by our photographer, Kevin Montag, but Arthur Liu, who is a colleague of Barry's in the school, did a lot of the digital photography as well. So we had very, very high-quality photographs to work from. And as we were talking earlier, the only painting that suffers in the book is that waterfall painting because it's the vertical.
Right, so it looks tiny. But,
yes, yeah. That would have happened to all the horizontals if we hadn't been able to decide to do it this way. So just big, lavish, full-color pictures of his work. Of course, this is just the tip of the iceberg of Barry's work, but a lot of the works we couldn't get for the show because they were in Germany or out west, and it was cost prohibitive to try to bring them back. So what is represented in the exhibition, for the most part, are things that were available within the U.S. and mostly within the region. We did add some images into the catalog section to augment that work that were not in the show, but that we had good quality images of.
Linda, you mentioned Arthur Liu, and that brings to mind the fact that Barry's relationships with other people in the department, not just, of course, the painting department, but across all of the different departments within the Hope School of Fine Arts, are rather remarkable and legendary. I wish that we could speak a little about your relationships with your colleagues, how they've enriched your work, and your relationship with your students over all of these years, and how that has informed your course as an artist.
I just love art. I mean, I just really, I've grown up with it. It means a lot to me to have colleagues like James and Arthur and Caleb and Tina are just something very special. You know, the Barneses are old dear friends that live in Maine. I mean, we're, you kind of like a little community. You can talk openly. You know, sometimes you worry about your ideas and you worry about certain things. You know, I think artists only have a handful of close art friends, you know. I mean, so we're not groupies. You know, we're such individuals, and we fight to keep that. And so, with Arthur and James, what's so nice there is that we're all so sympathetic to each other's work because we all do the same thing basically.
But it's also different. I mean, when you think about Arthur Liu doing video and James Nakagawa with his
but it's all about
photos.
The land. It's all about the history of the land. It's all about, you know, preservation of the land. And not to forget history. I'm not trying to overemphasize that, but I think to be an artist, you have to sort of be aware of a lot of things going on around you. And if you're not, the work doesn't have that impact. So when I go visit James's studio or see Arthur's video, I mean, I'm astonished what they're doing. I mean, it makes me knuckle down. I mean, I always feel like, and they're so respectful to Boulder. I'd love that. but the truth is, you see one of James's big photographs of Okinawa, the caves, it's like you're so jealous. He says, why am I not that heroic? Why am I not paying that pain? You see, you know, in Arthur's biggest, newest piece, one where he walks through Tibet, and just something incredible. It's mesmerizingly beautiful. And so they just sort of keep you on your toes, that your ideas are still there. And in a way, it's like gentle competition. Hmm. That's healthy.
And how about teaching? How about dealing with your protégés?
You know, I always thought you teach the grammar of the field. Like, I think students have to know how to do things, how to be creative, how to use their juices in a sense. Sometimes in my drawing class, it was very fundamental, actually, but they were about, you know, how to look with your own eye. What's the complexity of looking? Teaching is a great experience because, in a way, you don't have to teach what you do, but you teach the things that help you be who you are. And I try to do that. I think it's important to be an individual. I think you push as hard as you can in this field to be an individual. If you're a groupie, you don't make it. You know, I really mean that. I mean, you know, this is a tough field. To be being creative is not just patting yourself on the back. It's something. It's an ambition you tackle. And I'd rather fail at something creative than not being really creative. To be ordinary is not one of my ambitions. And it shouldn't be anybody's ambition in a university setting.
Well, we're coming to a close. Linda or Rachel, is there anything you'd like to say in summary about Barry's work and the exhibition?
Maybe not Barry's work, but about Barry. He's just remarkable. He's truly remarkable in his commitment to making art. I mean, the name of Rachel's essay is An Art Making Life. And I think it is rare, and especially probably rarer in an academic setting than anywhere else, where you have someone who's so dedicated at their core to having to be creative, to having to go into the studio every day, not as a chore or something he has to do or an obligation or out of a sense of guilt, but out of the need to do it, to be himself. He has to make art to be himself. He has to think about art. He has to teach art. He has to talk about it. It's just who he is. And I always knew that about him, but I didn't really understand it as deeply as I do now after having worked with him for the last several years. That's the man. And he's wonderful. Of course, he has other things. He's a great cook. He's wonderful just to hang out with. But he is a true artist in a way that's it's pretty rare.
And I feel sad that the exhibit is coming to a close because I feel like we're getting a divorce. It's been such a wild and wonderful ride all the way.
Can I just say thank you to both Rachel and Linda? Linda, I've known again for 40 years, and Rachel for the past few years. It's just been a great experience and very meaningful to me. And it's been rewarding for me to see my own work up, you know, like that, you know, for what I want to do next, really, and just see what I've done. Not all good, but did my best.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Artworks Yael Cassander speaking with artist and retired IU professor Barry Gelt. A retrospective of his work is on view in the Special Exhibitions Gallery at the Indiana University Art Museum through the month of December. They were joined in the studio by Rachel Berenson-Perry, the author of the essay in the catalog that accompanies the show, and Linda Baden, the curator of the Gelt Retrospective at the museum. The hardbound, full-color catalog of Barry Gelt Embracing Nature is available through the IU Press. For WFIU's Artworks, I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening. Production support for Artworks comes from the Brown County Art Guild, featuring a collection by early 20th century painters and over 50 contemporary artists. Located in the historic Minor Home in the heart of downtown Nashville, hours and featured exhibit information at browncountyartguild.org. And the Ferrer Gallery, a gallery in downtown Nashville showcasing original, contemporary, and traditional art and fine crafts of South Central Indiana. Over 30 artists represented in a variety of mediums. If you'd like to suggest a topic for Artworks or subscribe to our weekly podcast, visit us online at wfiu.org/artworks. You can always send us an email to arts@indianapublicmedia.org or follow us on Twitter at username WFIU Arts. Artworks is a production of WFIU.